here. And by the way, please feel free to ask questions. I assume that's the tradition here, to ask questions during. Yes, okay. Because it says quantum discussion. Right? Okay, so the title is Discrete Phase Space and Minimum Uncertainty States. So these will be states which are minimum uncertainty with respect to a particular information theoretic uncertainty principle. This is for discrete systems, for the finite dimensional state space. This is intimately tied up with a particular kind of discrete phase space and the Wigner function that goes with it. And part of the motivation originally was just as a coherent state is kind of, in a certain sense, is the best quantum approximation to a classical point in phase space. I was looking for some sort of better interpretation of the points of our discrete phase space, which might be then represented by minimum uncertainty states, which would be legal quantum states, whereas the points of phase space, as in the continuous case, are illegal as quantum states. That's going to turn out not to be the case. These minimum uncertainty states are not actually going to serve that purpose. My motivation now is just we're looking for minimum uncertainty states just for the sake of finding minimum uncertainty states. And one might be able to make an argument that they're useful in quantum cryptography. They're kind of interesting in their own right, even though they're not what I originally thought they would be. Anyway, so here is the outline. So I'll talk first about mutually unbiased bases, which are used in this information theoretic uncertainty principle. And then discrete phase space and how you can use discrete phase space to generate a set of mutually unbiased bases. And then we'll get to this information theoretic uncertainty principle and minimum uncertainty states. Okay, so let me start with the very simplest case of single qubit. These three bases, up, down, right, left, and in and out, are mutually unbiased in the sense that if you expand any one of those state vectors in one of the other bases, you get something with equal magnitude coefficients. So there are three bases that are as different from each other as they could possibly be. And that's a handy thing to have in state determination, state estimation. So here's a very simple problem. You have a bunch of qubits coming in with some unknown state, which might be a mixed state. So maybe these are photons coming with some unknown polarization state. One way to figure out what the state is just to randomly assign these photons, that's what the beam splitter is doing, to three different measurements that you might make on each photon, which are those three, associated with those three directions on the sphere. So for example, the x one, let me just go back. If you measure in the x direction, you just count how many go this way and how many go that way, and that tells you basically what plane you are perpendicular to that axis. And you measure how many go up and how many go down. That tells you what plane you are, what horizontal plane you're on. And similarly for the third dimension. So with those three, you can pin down your quantum state. And notice that each measurement probes a different dimension in the space of density matrices, which is this interior of the sphere. Now let's move to two qubits. For two qubits, you can ask, can you find a bunch of orthogonal bases which have this property that they're unbiased with respect to each other, in the sense that each element of one basis is an equal magnitude superposition of the states of another basis. So they are as different from each other as possible. You can say they're mutually conjugate. And you can ask, how many of those could you find? For the purpose of state estimation, it turns out that what you would need is five. And you may have already noticed that there are five sitting there, but pretend you haven't seen that. You're looking for five of these bases. And the reason is that a density matrix a 4x4 density matrix has 15 real parameters to be determined. One of these orthogonal measurements with four outcomes, if you count how many particles, how many of these two-qubit pairs give each of these four outcomes, you get four probabilities. You're measuring four probabilities, but they add up to one, so you just have three independent ones. And so each measurement is giving you three independent numbers. You need 15, so you'll need five distinct orthogonal measurements to completely reconstruct the state of two qubits. And it's nice if you can find these five to be as different from each other as possible, which is to say that they're mutually unbiased. And indeed, you can find these. Three of them are very simple. They're just sort of two copies of the single qubit measurements. But then the last two are entangled measurements. I call them, I had to have some names for them. They're called the Bell and Bow bases because there is the Bell measurement named after John Bell, which is an entangled measurement. And this is different from that, so it couldn't be called exactly the same thing.
Bill?
Yes.
It's kind of just symbolically, there's a third variation of Bell and Bow where you mix and match the other.
Oh, yeah. Well, let's see. That would be where you change this to up.
So the first of all, you're taking the first and the third row, and then the bow you're taking the
oh, I see.
Second and third. So the first
right.
And second row, I guess.
Oh, I see. And we could do something. Let's see. What are you suggesting? You take
in, out, right, left.
In, out, and right. Okay, I see. So in, right, and out, left. Good question. Let's see. In, right, and out, left. Yeah, how is that related to these?
Maybe it was not a good question.
It's a good question. Well, I don't know off the top of my head where that fits in. It does seem kind of like a natural thing. Maybe it's equivalent to one of these. I mean, you know, you change the bases. You can rewrite these things in different ways, these entangled states, right? You know, for example, the singlet state can be written up, down, minus, down, up, or it can be written right, left, minus, left, right. Those are equal. So my guess is that something like that is going on. Like the first one of that basis might be the third one of this basis or something like that. And so for state estimation, so imagine these little qubit molecules, pairs of qubits coming in. Again, you split them now into five different sub-ensembles, and each one you perform one of these four outcome orthogonal measurements. And as I was saying, each one provides three real parameters because you have four probabilities that add up to one. There are five of them that adds up to 15 parameters, which is what you need to specify a 4x4 density matrix. And by the way, if you think of the space of density matrices, this 15-dimensional space here, say with the origin taken as the completely mixed state, then each of these measurements probes orthogonal dimensions of that space. So you have three dimensions for one measurement, three dimensions for another measurement. So they really are probing, they're really as different from each other as possible. And that way they're sort of efficient for state determination. So one might well ask, for what dimensions can you do this trick? This is what we know. There exist at most d plus 1 such bases for given dimension, state space dimension d. And that's exactly the number that you would need for state estimation, because in general, a density matrix would have d squared minus 1 real parameters to be determined. Each measurement, orthogonal measurement, would provide d minus 1 independent probabilities. And so that means you'd need d plus 1 of these different measurements. It turns out you can never find more than that. That's not too hard to show. And it's also known that this bound is achieved if d is a power or prime. Then you can find a complete set of these mutually unbiased bases. And for other values of d, even for d equals 6, which is not a power or prime, it is not known whether that many bases exist. Even though people have tried hard to find them. So it's funny that that's not known even for 6 dimensions. We now move to this discrete phase space business and how you can construct mutually unbiased bases via this discrete phase space construction. And along the way, we'll define a discrete bigger function. But that's not central to this talk. So the Beach-Fan Bayes spaces are central. OK, so here's our discrete phase space for a single qubit. Instead of position and momentum, which would be the normal axes for phase space, you have this little simple thing. It's up and down, takes the values up and down. And the conjugate variable takes the values right and left. But in order to talk about, in order to do some, to talk about lines and parallel lines, we need some arithmetic on the space. So we're going to assign the number 0, 1. I'll call that variable q. And then this other variable also takes the value 0 and 1. And the arithmetic for those guys is mod 2. So that means that now you can define a line as just a solution to a linear equation. Parallel lines are solutions with the same slope, but different intercepts. So here are two parallel lines. Here's another set of parallel lines. And that's the third set of parallel lines. And those are all the lines in this phase space. And the idea is that each set of parallel lines, which we're calling a striation, is to be associated with a particular measurement. And here's how that happens. And they're going to be these mutually unbiased points. So you can do translations in the phase space. So moving to the right or moving up. So adding one horizontally just interchanges these two because of the modular arithmetic, which means physically what you're doing is you're taking up to down and down to up, but you're not changing right and left if you're just going horizontally. And so it's natural to associate a unitary operator with that translation, which is the Pauli X operator. It just takes up to down, down to up, but it doesn't change right and left. And similarly, vertical translations like this just interchange right and left, but don't change up and down. So we associate the Z operator with that, the Pauli Z operator with that. And then this kind of translation is just a combination of those two. You do this and do this. And I'm not worried about the order of those particularly, which would change the sign, because the sign's never going to matter for any of our stuff. OK, so what we want to do now is we're going to associate with each one of these striations a basis for the state space. In fact, we're going to associate with each line of a striation a particular vector, a state vector. And how are we going to do that? The only thing we're going to insist is this kind of translational covariance, that when you translate, P is going to be the state associated with a line, lambda, in the state space, in the phase space, rather. If you apply a translation operator to that, we insist that you get the state that's assigned to the line that's been translated by the appropriate amount. In particular, this implies that the diagonal lines are associated with the eigenstates of the Pauli Y operator. Because if you translate this line here in this direction, it doesn't change at all. So therefore, the corresponding state that you associate with that line has to be an eigenstate of that translation operator, which is Y. OK, so we have an orthogonal basis associated with each striation of the phase space. And here's a summary of three striations with their bases. So this striation gets associated with the up-down basis, this with the right-left basis, and this with the in-out basis. And so this, in this sense, this discrete phase space construction generates a complete set of mutually unbiased spaces. And at this point, you should not be impressed at all about that. I mean, I doubt that you are. These are kind of simple to generate anyway. But it gets more interesting with two qubits. Which we'll see in just a minute. But while we're here, let's talk about the discrete Wigner function. We're going to define a discrete Wigner function on this phase space. And the key property of the Wigner function is that if you sum the Wigner function, it's just going to be a real function on phase space that represents a quantum state. If you sum that thing over any line, you're supposed to get the probability of the outcome of the measurement that's associated with that line. Now, there's some ambiguity here, because although we know that the eigenstates of the Pauli Y operator, which are in and out, are assigned to these two lines, nothing that I've said forces us to choose one or the other. So there's some freedom there. In the following slide, we make this particular choice. So here is a Wigner function for a single qubit. And by the way, this appears in a paper by Feynman, 1987, called Negative Probabilities. It's the same construction here. So here's the Wigner function for the upstate. The Wigner function consists of these four numbers. And you can see that if you sum it over the vertical lines, you get the correct probabilities for up and down. If you sum over the horizontal lines, you get the correct probabilities for right and left. And if you sum over the diagonal lines, you get the correct probabilities for in and out. Okay, so it's just set up to do that. Here's another example. This is the on the block sphere. This is a state that's pointing sort of in that direction, negative eigenstate of this operator. And I give this example because has a negative value. So this Wigner function takes negative values as the continuous Wigner function does. And that's as negative as these guys get for the one-qubit case. And so now we're going to move to the two-qubit case. Constructing mutually unbiased bases via discrete phase space in the two-qubit case. So here's the phase space. We have, imagine these two qubits pictured as spin 1/2 particles. Here's our position analog, and here's our momentum analog. But we also assign numbers to those variables. And the numbers in this case are the elements of the four-element field, GF4, which normally I would expect that no one in the audience would have seen that. But in this particular case, I'm sure that many have, because it pops up in quantum error correction. Anyway, here is the four-element field. It has this kind of modular addition, 1 plus 1. Anything added to itself is 0. Omega is just this abstract symbol. It's not. Don't try to solve this for the complex numbers that satisfy that. That's not what I mean. Okay, it's just an abstract symbol. Here's the arithmetic it satisfies. Omega cubed is equal to 1. Omega times omega squared equals 1. It's the only commutative, associative, and distributive arithmetic on four elements. Sets of addition, multiplication are both invertible, which is to say it's a field. So that's what we're talking about. Those are the element. Why do I choose that? Because it works out very nicely. So you can use that arithmetic to define lines and parallel lines.
But what does addition mean?
Oh, what does addition mean? Oh, physically.
Yeah.
What does it mean physically? Oh, yeah.
Oh, yeah, up, down, up, or right, left, and left, what am I getting?
All right, very good. So if you do addition, actually, that's right here. If you suppose you add 1 in the horizontal direction. Okay, so I'm translating by 1 unit in the horizontal direction.
That means flip the right hand and spin.
It means flip the first, flip the second spin.
Yeah, flip the spin on the right.
Flip the spin on the right and flip it in a particular way that up goes to down and down goes to up, but you don't change right and left. That is to say, you flip it around this axis. That's what it means. So addition actually means something physically in this case. And what about adding omega? So if you add omega, you can see what that does. You're just flipping the first of the two spins. Right. And that's true for this case. Yeah. So translations make sense. Let's talk about vertical translations. So if you add 1 in the vertical direction, go up 1 in the vertical direction, then you're flipping right to left and left to right of the second particle. And that corresponds to this operator. So these things have operators that they correspond to. It's very natural, okay, given this interpretation of the state space. Does that make sense? Okay.
Moving by omega squared is flipping multiple.
Oh, yes, exactly. Because omega squared is 1 plus omega. And so if you add omega squared, it's like adding 1 and then adding omega. So you're flipping both. So these things all make sense. And in general, if you have some common, we can talk about a if you do some general translation in some funny direction, you just do a combination of the basic translations. That's what this is saying. You just combine all the basic ones. And I don't care what order you do them in, because if there's a phase factor, that's not going to make any difference. So here are the sets of parallel lines for the two-qubit phase space. So you just figure out what are the solutions to linear equations in this funny arithmetic. And here they are. So those are the lines. And I've grouped them into sets of parallel lines. You can see that these are parallel because they don't intersect. Right? And you can also see that if you take two lines from different sets of parallel lines, they will intersect in exactly one place. Right? So this one and this one intersect exactly right here. Okay. So a lot of your intuition about lines and parallel lines goes through in this case. So there they are, the five striations. And the idea is that we're going to associate an orthogonal basis with each one of those in the same way that we did in the one qubit case. Let's find the basis that goes with this, with these set of funny lines. Okay. So here are four parallel lines. And the way you do it is you note that each of these lines is invariant under three translations. So translation by one in the horizontal direction and omega in the vertical direction. That means going from here to here. So that translation interchanges these two dots, interchanges those two points, and so it leaves this line invariant. It also leaves all the other lines invariant, if you see what it does to the other points. And similarly, these lines are invariant under this translation, also this one. So what you do is that the states that you assign to these lines, the quantum states you assign to these lines, have to be eigenstates of all of these. But these do commute with each other, so they do have simultaneous eigenvectors. And when you work it out, you find what you get, lo and behold, is this basis, which is the Bethe basis, okay, that we had before. It's one of the five mutually invited bases. And if you do the same thing for all the other sets of parallel lines, you get, so here are all the sets of parallel lines, you get all those bases that we had before. So these three simple ones, and then the two weird entangled ones, they come out naturally from this. You just find the eigenvalues of these operators, eigenvectors of these operators. Okay, so that's kind of neat, that this construction generates mutually unbiased bases. And now if you want to define a Wigner function, that is a Wigner function for two qubits, that is a real function on this phase space. That's that if you sum over any line, you get the probability of the outcome, of the measured outcome that's associated with that line. There's some freedom in how to do that, because you have to decide, we know what basis goes with this striation, but which vector goes with this particular line. You have four choices there. And then having made that choice, the others are determined by the translation operators. And similarly, the weird striations, you get that kind of freedom. So you have a number of possibilities for defining the Wigner function. Clearly, this number is growing quickly as the state space dimension is getting bigger. But here are some examples of Wigner functions with a particular choice of how to make that assignment. So here, for example, this is the up-up state. And you can see that if you sum over the vertical lines, you get the correct probabilities of these, of up, 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 down, down, up, and down, down. And if you sum over the horizontal lines, you get the correct probabilities for those measurements and so on. Here's an entangled state, the singlet state. And you can see that you get the right probabilities. Up, down, and down, up, both have probability 1/2. But so do right, left, and left, right. They have probability 1/2, which is true for the singlet state. And then you can also sum over the weird lines and get the correct probabilities for them. So those are some examples of Wigner functions. But as I say, the focus here is not so much on the Wigner function as on just the phase space itself.
Sorry.
Yeah.
Yes. Sum over the weird lines to get, say, YY?
Oh, yeah. Okay, so if you sum over this line, it gives you the probability of N out, because I've associated the state in out with that line. So this is the probability of n out, which is 1/2. And this is the probability of out n, which is also 1/2. And then you sum over this line, so the probability of n, which is 0. And you sum over this line to get the probability of out, which is 0. So that's all correct for the singlet state. And you can also sum over like this line. This plus that plus that plus that gives you probability 1/4 of this weird entangled state, whatever it was, up, right, plus I, down, left, or something like that.
The same works for the other thing, right?
And the same works for this one. Yes, for any state, you can write down its Wigner function, it'll have all these properties. So that's the idea. That if you the Wigner function itself can have negative values, but if you sum over any line, you get something non-negative, which can actually be interpreted as a probability. So that's the spirit of the Wigner function. And this works, this kind of same kind of construction works for any dimension d, as long as d is a power of a prime. Okay, so there exists a finite field having exactly d elements, if and only if d is a power of a prime. So 4, it worked because 4 is power of 2. And then you make a d by d phase space, okay, whose q and p, the analogs of position and momentum, take values in this crazy finite field, which typically has some weird kind of arithmetic. And so that's what you, and then you can associate in a natural way a unitary translation operator with each point. That is, if you do a translation by a certain vector in the phase space, that's associated with a unitary operator on the spun state. And once you make those assignments, then you can say, okay, well then what is the quantum state, or what are the quantum states I should assign to a particular set of parallel lines? Well, those lines are going to be invariant under particular kinds of translations. Those translation operators will have a certain set of eigenstates, a definite, unique set of eigenstates, and that will be one of the mutually unbiased bases, that set of eigenstates. Yeah.
So before you said, for 4 elements, there was only one commutative, distributive, associated arithmetic structure that gave you a field.
Yeah.
So is that what gives the dB the prime? Is that true for any power of prime?
Yes, for any power of prime, there's exactly one field with that many elements.
And so that's why this works.
And that's why this works. Right, so you have this unique arithmetic. Okay. And you're building on that. And it also works because of some theorems proved by Bhandapati and Pittenger and Rubin. This is part of what goes into this construction. Did I say that these things are automatically mutually unbiased? So that's the special thing about this particular construction. Okay, and that's the end of the little piece of the talk that's on mutually unbiased bases and discrete Hilbert space, discrete phase space rather. Okay, now let's talk about let's work towards getting an information theoretic uncertainty principle, which is in terms of
Sorry, just before you go on.
Yeah.
Is there a way to see that procedure doesn't work for 6?
6. Right, so you try with 6, you have a 6 by 6 phase space, and you immediately bump into a problem, because what do you use to assign? You could use the number 0 through 5, for example, to label the axes. And then you can define lines by modular arithmetic. But you quickly bump into problems, largely because these lines don't intersect, non-parallel lines don't necessarily intersect each other, or they can intersect in more than one place. It turns out that kind of feature is what's crucial for making these mutually unbiased bases. It's important that the non-parallel lines intersect each other in exactly one spot, at one point. Let me show you. Even in the case of 4x4, if you don't use the field arithmetic, but if you use this arithmetic, 0, 1, 2, 3, 0, 1, 2, 3, with modular arithmetic, and you write down what's a line, okay, well then it's just wrap around. Okay, so our line might be this, and this, and then that's this, and this. So there's a line. And then here's a non-parallel line that doesn't intersect it. And that turns out to be the crucial thing for making these mutually unbiased bases. It's important that the lines intersect in exactly one place. That's sort of like, I mean, if you associate a basis with these lines, then that basis would have a different, these two elements of that basis would have a different relationship to this state, whatever state you assign to this one, than these two elements of the basis would. And with the field arithmetic, you don't bump into that. And so that's why you want these things to be built on a field. I don't know if that answers.
It crucially depends on the field arithmetic.
So yeah, it really crucially depends on this weird field arithmetic, which is kind of cool in its own right, so it's fun to play with, right? So now, suppose you've got these bases, which we do have for any power of prime dimension. Then you can make this information theoretic uncertainty principle along the following lines. So let's go back to the single qubit case. We've got these three mutually unbiased measurements, up, down, right, left, and in, out. Let's consider the following. Take any pure state, which is to say any point on the surface of the sphere. And let's ask, what are the probabilities of up and down, for example? And the probabilities of right and left, and the probabilities of in and out. It's not hard to convince yourself that this fact is true. If you add up the squares of all six of those probabilities, you get 2. Anyway, one can check that out, regardless of what the state is. So for any pure state, you get the same number. Let's just check it out for this case. For the state that's up, the probabilities are 1, 0, and then half, 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 and half. If you add up the squares of those, you get 2. And then here's an interesting fact. If for any prime power dimension, or in fact, for any dimension for which a complete set of mutually unbiased bases exists, which may be for every dimension for all we know, okay, but that certainly exists for all prime power dimensions. But it follows from this paper that if you do have a complete set of these mutually unbiased bases, and then you take any pure state vector and figure out the probabilities of the outcomes of this measurement and this measurement and this measurement, at sum the squares of all of those probabilities, you get 2. Okay, you might have thought this 2 had to do with the fact that this was a two-dimensional state space and that this would be D, but no, it's just always 2. So that's an interesting fact. And from that, it follows that you have this information theoretic uncertainty principle. Basically, the idea here is we're trying to quantify the fact that if you know a lot about one of these measurements, about the outcome of one of these, if you can predict the outcome of one of these measurements very well, then you can't predict very much about the outcomes of the other measurements. So it's like the Heisenberg uncertainty principle, except with more measurements than just 2. Heisenberg has position and momentum. Now we have a whole bunch of these things. If you know one of them perfectly, you know nothing about any of the others. All right, are you with me? Okay, so that's what we're trying to express quantitatively. So again, we start with this, that the sum of the squares of all these probabilities, these are the probabilities of the outcomes of measurements for some given state, pure state, is always equal to 2. So if we average, so now this average means averaging over the D plus 1 mutually unbiased bases. So you're averaging over all these bases. What that means is you take the sum of all the bases and then you divide by D plus 1, which is the number of them. So that's why I've divided by D plus 1. So that's the average of this sum of the squares of the probabilities over all the mutually unbiased bases. And now, because the negative logarithm is a convex function, the average of the negative logarithm of that thing over all the mutually unbiased bases is bigger than or equal to the negative logarithm of the average itself. And that's your information theoretic uncertainty principle, because the negative logarithm of the sum of the squares of the probabilities is an information theoretic quantity. It's the Renyi entropy of order 2. So I'll call it H sub R, the Renyi entropy of order 2, or just Renyi entropy for short, The average of that is at least this much. This quantifies how much uncertainty you have about the outcome of these measurements. And it says, basically, you have to have a certain amount of uncertainty. The biggest that this thing can possibly be is log of d. Log of d is the largest value of this. And you can see for large d, this average is very close to log of d. You're almost, so as d increases, the maximum amount of uncertainty you could have about the outcome increases as log of d. And the amount of uncertainty you actually have for any quantum state averaged over all those measurements increases right along with it. So you have almost as much uncertainty as one could possibly have on average. In fact, you have only about one bit of information, is about all you can get. Okay, so this is just an information theoretic uncertainty principle applicable to all these different conjugate measurements. So what I want to find is a minimum uncertainty state in this sense, in the sense that it achieves this bound, that it has the least possible uncertainty. And here's a strategy for finding minimum uncertainty state. Let's find a unitary operator U that cycles through all the mutually unbiased bases. Okay, this is a strategy that the existence of that actually was shown independently by Chow. Although we'll use a slightly different method. Then each eigenstate of U is automatically a minimum uncertainty state because it has the same Renyi entropy for each of the bases. And this point has been noticed by these authors also.
What does it mean to cycle through MUBs? By iterating U?
Yes, exactly, by iterating U. So let me give you the example of a single qubit case. So your mutually unbiased bases are these three bases, right, which you can easily picture, which is nice. And so it's not hard to imagine a unitary transformation that just rotates by 120 degrees around this sort of intermediate axis. And it sure enough cycles through those three bases. That's exactly what we're trying to generalize here. So if you do that, so then the eigenstates of that, which in this case you can see what the eigenstates are, they're just this and this. Those are minimum uncertainty states. Okay. So as I was saying, the one qubit case is easy to picture because you can imagine these rotations. And in that case, I mean, the Renyi entropy can be at most one bit for a single qubit, but all you can know, your entropy has to be on average 0.585 bits, as it turns out. Okay, so you can't know everything. I mean, that's clear, but this is the best you can do to use that state there. Well, can you do this in general? So how can we use discrete phase space to find a U like that cycles through all of the mutually unbiased bases, and such that its eigenstates then will be minimum uncertainty states? Well, here's how you do it. You choose a good quadratic polynomial for your phase space. So here you have, this is our Q and P, which take the values 0, 1, omega, and omega squared. This is the two qubit case that we considered before. And we find a polynomial. What I mean by good is it's a homogeneous quadratic polynomial in Q and P. And it has to be such that if the value of this thing is 0, if you stick in values of Q and P, like maybe Q equals omega and P equals 1, you can never get 0 unless Q and P themselves are both 0. So that's what I mean by a good quadratic polynomial. So, and then the value of this, so, and then points on which this thing takes a certain constant value will just define to be circles. So here are some circles. Here are three circles for this two qubit phase space. There's a circle, and then the other ones are our circles. And that's the origin, which is the center of these circles.
So does center polynomial always exist?
Oh, yes, it does. Yes, it does. Such a polynomial. Who's asking that? Yes, such a polynomial always exists. Right. And not only that, but you also have to question, can you find a rotation? R, which is to say a linear transformation of this phase space. So it's a 2x2 matrix whose components are values of them in the finite field. So it acts on points in the phase space, just a linear transformation, moves them around to other points. You can look for a rotation R which preserves circles. So it might take this point to this point, to this point, to this point, to this point, and then back to this point. Yes?
So if it were zero, what would happen?
Oh, well, then.
There's some degeneracy.
Then there's some degeneracy. That's not what we mean by circles. But that is, it means that the circle of zero radius is not just the origin, but something bigger.
So in other words, these quadratic polynomials that never vanish map subsets of points just into each other. Is that right?
Well, what this does is it just defines your circles. That's all it's doing. So where this takes a particular value, say 1, that defines a certain circle.
So that's sort of a circle of radius 1.
It's a circle of radius 1, exactly. Right, exactly. So you have circles of radius 1, a circle of radius omega,
and
of omega squared.
And radius 0 is.
And radius 0 is this one, it's just the origin. Yes.
And the circles don't intersect, huh?
And the circles don't intersect. That's right.
That's fair, right?
Because
if you plug in some numbers, you can only get one answer.
That's true. If you plug in numbers, you can only get one answer. That's right.
Okay.
Yeah.
So there's the idea is there's a unitary that bounces around.
That's what's going to happen.
Cycles around each circle.
That's the idea. And the way we get to it is we first start with just a linear transformation of the phase space. We first start in phase space language, where we're just moving things around in this little space with a 2x2 matrix. And then we use the fact that for every such transformation, as long as it has unit determinant, you can find a unitary transformation that corresponds to it in the state space, which moves the translation operators around in the same way. That's the idea.
And so is RS related to the Galois group of the
polynomial? The R is related to the, it probably is. That's
right,
what I think.
You know, probably is. You know, the polynomial equals.
You're probably right. I mean, it's not hard to get from here to the R. In general, though, it is a little bit tricky to find a primitive R. You have to find one that generates the whole circle. That's not a problem here because you have 5 elements in the circle. There's no way you can't do that. But for example, for 3 qubits, it's an 8x8 phase space, and each circle has 9 points. So you might have an R that has cycle 3. That has a 3 cycle.
So it skips over some.
It skips over some. We don't want that.
So
we want
one of R go max every point.
Exactly. So R is going to generate, go through all the points of the circle. And there's a unitary U that's associated with that that's going to go through all the mutually unbiased bases. And the way to understand that geometrically is that each circle, let's say take this circle here, goes through every single ray. Okay, that is, you take lines of different slopes through the origin, and there are going to be 5 of them, and those 5 lines through the origin with different slopes will intersect those 5 points of this circle. And remember that the directions in phase space are associated with these mutually unbiased bases, so that when you cycle through the circle, you're also cycling through the mutually unbiased bases. So it's a neat, you can make this neat sort of geometric. You get a lot of intuition by this geometry.
And so there's always d minus 1 of these circles.
That's correct. There are always d minus 1 of the circles, and each circle has d plus 1 points. And so you're cycling through d plus 1.
You're looking for a primitive that jumps through every one of those.
Exactly. Points. And so that what that does is it generates a unitary transformation that has cycle d plus 1, which indeed cycles through all. You started on one basis, and it goes through all of the mutually unbiased spaces. So
U takes one circle around itself and the other one around itself.
That's correct.
But not one to the other.
That's correct. That's exactly correct.
So how many, is there more than one U?
Yes, there are. Because any power of U, any power of U will have that property, still preserve circles.
Yeah,
so once you have U, you can take powers of it and it will also, although not all those powers will be printed.
Are there any, if anything else, that's not trivially related? well, maybe that's not trivial, but I mean, is there, are there any other options?
No, actually, we've looked at, my student Daniel Sussman in particular has done a lot of work on this to show that if you make a different choice of circles, you don't end up with anything that's fundamentally different. You get a different U, but its properties are essentially the same. So the crucial properties are the same. I mean, there is some arbitrariness in the choice of circles, but the arbitrariness doesn't have any bad consequences. Yeah, Richard?
How do you choose the
quadratic polynomial?
Right. Well, you choose it arbitrarily. It's sort of like...
I guess good in this case is irreducible, right?
It has to be irreducible, right.
It doesn't have the root, so, yeah.
That's exactly it. It comes from irreducible. That's the crucial word there, which I haven't said until now. Thank you for saying it. Right. So you choose an irreducible polynomial and you can make this. Okay. But it does not have to be a primitive polynomial. All right.
So
this U cycles through. So you can do this, and we've shown that you can do this for any number of qubits. Okay. Any number of qubits, you can do this. Okay. You can construct a U in precisely this way, and it will cycle through all the mutually unbiased spaces. So what you have there is kind of a nice way of generating.
Provided it's a power of prime.
A power of two, in fact. So the state space dimension is 2 to the number of qubits. Okay, so for any power of 2, which is to say for any number of qubits, so the state space division will be 2 to the number of qubits, you can do this. And it works. And that leads me to the next, that's a nice segue to the next slide, which is that it does not work for odd dimensions. Because here's circles, and I hope you think it's kind of pretty. I spent some time thinking about the colors. Anyway, these are circles in dimension 7. So you have a 7x7 phase space. So you have this sort of discrete position and discrete momentum. If you want, you can think of a physical system, which is just 7 sites that a particle could be at that are arranged in a circle. Because there's this, it's modular arithmetic now. The field with 7 elements is just ordinary arithmetic mod 7. So it's very familiar. And also, the circles can be nicer. In the qubit case, the circles can't be this. That never works for a number of qubits. But here, the circles can be what you think circles should be. Q squared plus P squared equals a constant. Okay. So these are the solutions of this for different values of C. And if C equals 0, you only get the origin. And then if C takes some other value, you get these other values, get these other circles.
Each color is a circle?
Each color is a circle.
Of a different radius?
Of a different radius. That's right. And they're all circles around the origin, despite what your eyes may tell you. Okay.
So, I mean, does it work if you use polynomials to a different degree, like the characteristic of the field? So for 7, uses degree 7 polynomial. Quadratic polynomial for 2.
Oh, no, that never occurred to me.
One possible.
Yeah, no, I don't know. I have to think about that. But I was just thinking circles. Mm-hmm. We want circles, and circles are like, you know, quadratic. And so you define circles. The whole idea is you define these circles, you find these rotation operators that preserve circles, and then you find unitary operators that correspond to the rotations, and those are going to cycle through all the mutually unbiased spaces. That was the hope. But and then here, in this case, it doesn't work, because you'll notice that consider all the various rays, going those lines of different slope going through the origin. Notice that this line doesn't hit all the circles, for example. And so if you're cycling through a circle, suppose you're cycling through these kind of yellow goldish circles, then this circle rather, then you never hit the vertical ray. Which means that if you've got a unitary transformation, and you can find one, you can find a unitary transformation that corresponds to that, but it won't go through all the mutually unbiased bases. It just goes through half of them. And never hits the basis that's associated with that ray, for example, and never hits the basis that's associated with that ray.
Maybe there is a polynomial of higher degree and generating U.
Maybe. I have not, that never occurred to me. This is one reason why it's great to give these talks, right? So, anyway, but this doesn't work. However, It turns out, and I can regard this as kind of a lucky thing, that although it doesn't go through, you can define these U's, unitaries that are associated with these circles, and you can't make the argument that I made before about why it's going to be a minimum uncertainty state. Nevertheless, so before, every eigenstate of U had to be a minimum uncertainty state because it treated all these bases equally. And that's what made it minimum uncertainty. But in this case, it's not true that all the eigenstates of one of these U's is a minimum uncertainty state, but it always happens to be true that one of them is. So you can still use this method to generate minimum uncertainty states.
Sorry, so that's true for all prime powers?
I'm sorry. We focused on this particular case where the prime is of this particular form.
But for primes, you don't really even need to do much work because there's the bases are the field elements, right? And there's a primitive element of the field that generates that. So
true, but how do you find a minimum uncertainty state?
No, but the point is that you have, but the point is you have a unitary that will cycle through all the MEVs.
No.
Yeah, because the primitive element of the field, multiplication by that element, is a permutation of the field.
Right, that is true.
And that'll take you all the way through the field, and that gives you a unitary.
Oh, it won't give you the infinite slope line. So you're saying you get all the slopes. You can get all the slopes except for the infinite slope that way.
Maybe not.
Or something like that. Is that what you're saying? You sort of take the slopes of these, right?
I don't think so. I mean, so you're mapping, well, maybe you do
that. Anyway, I don't think you can do it.
I
don't think there exists such a unit here. Anyway, but this one works remarkably. At least there's a specific eigenstate. Let me just show you the details. How long am I supposed to? I'm supposed to stop right about now.
Another 5 minutes.
Is that right? Okay. So here's some details for prime D. I'm almost done. For prime D of the form, and we use this form, like 3, 7, 11. Primes that are one less than a multiple of 4, because then q squared plus p squared equals constant defines circles. And so that's very nice. For the other cases, that doesn't define circles, because it's not a primitive polynomial. So this case is particularly simple. And we just choose u. Basically, we choose u so that it's so that the Wigner function of u, if you will, is so omega now is not the omega that we had before. It's either the 2 pi I over d. It's a deep root of unity. That to something proportional to q squared plus p squared is kind of the Wigner function of the u. So you use that to define a unitary. And sure enough, that unitary does do exactly what you want. It goes around the circles. And its eigenvalues look like this. They have to be of unit length because it's a unitary operator. So this is the unit circle in the complex plane. And these are the eigenvalues of u for the case of seven dimensions. So you have 7 eigenvalues. They're all distinct. And they're equally spaced around the unit circle. And there's one that's not there. And it turns out the one that's opposite to the one that's not there, that goes with the special eigenstate, which is a minimum uncertainty state. Okay, that's just how to do it. I wanted to talk about Shannon entropy, because here so far we've talked about Renyi entropy. Shannon entropy is just a different entropy here, more commonly used. The uncertainty principle works just as well for Shannon as for Renyi, because the Shannon entropy is always at least as big as the Renyi entropy. So you have the same lower bound for Shannon entropy. I like to think in terms of information that you have. Entropy is sort of how much information you lack, how unable you are to predict the outcome of a measurement. If you take the difference between that and the maximum amount of information you could possibly lack, that you can think of as the amount of information you have about the outcome of a measurement. And the amount of information you have is not very much. It's always less than, on average, again, over all these different mutually unbiased measurements, it's always less than 1 bit of information. And in fact, it's a little bit it's less by an amount that actually diminishes as d increases. So we might ask, do our minimum uncertainty states, which are minimum uncertainty in the Rennie information sense, also minimize the average Shannon entropy? It turns out not always. Some low-dimensional cases, anyway, you can find counterexamples. And also the Shannon, whereas the Rennie entropy is this very nice thing. It behaves very, this is the Rennie information. How much information do you have in the Rennie sense? You never have more than one bit of information on average about all these different measurements, averaged over all these different measurements. But you can approach one as the dimension gets bigger. So this is the Rennie information that you have, which is a nice, smooth thing. In contrast, the Shannon information is this funny thing that doesn't behave in any predictable way. I wanted to talk about, are our minimum uncertainty states special? Are they typical? It turns out, not to go into the details, for if you just take a random state, a random pure state in a huge, in a large state space, the amount of Shannon information you have about an orthogonal measurement, so you have an orthogonal measurement, take a random state and ask how well can I predict the outcome of this orthogonal measurement? The answer is, this is about how much information I have about the outcome. And in the limit of very large dimension of the state space, almost every state that you pick will have about that much information. That is, take a random state. It's a very good bet that you're going to have that much information about the outcome of any orthogonal measurement that you might randomly pick. So that's a measure of, this gamma is the Euler constant. This is characteristic of a typical state. And is our state typical? No, it's not. Our minimum uncertainty states are not typical. This is a sort of a, what the distribution of probability amplitudes looks like. And it turns out that leads to a conjecture that in the limit of large d, the amount of Shannon information you have should be this thing, 1 over 2 log 2, which is 0.721, which is bigger than what you get for a typical state. Here's a picture of that. So here's we have this conjecture that this thing is trying to approach this line. But a typical state would have Shannon entropy about like this. So our minimum uncertainty states are at least better than a typical state. We're talking about not very much information. Remember, it's always about one bit. One might also ask, are our minimum uncertainty states like coherent states? Well, we can talk about Wigner functions for our minimum uncertainty states. A coherent state always has a positive Wigner function. But in the continuous case, a coherent state, like the ground state of a harmonic oscillator, is a minimum uncertainty state. So we might think, oh, maybe there's a connection between our minimum uncertainty states and the coherent states. But it's not very obvious if there is a connection, because coherent states all have positive Wigner function. Our states typically don't have positive discrete Wigner function. We found one rare exception for the case of three qubits that has positive Wigner function. This is the Wigner function, maximum at the origin, and then it gets smaller on these circles as you go out from the origin, so to speak. So it's kind of like a coherent state. But it's only for three qubits that we found this. It didn't work for any other number of qubits that we've tried, up to 7 qubits. We can't find anything like a coherent state. So I don't think they're like coherent states. I think that may about better stop. I have some other ways in which they're not like coherent states, and that's when you go to the conclusions, which is the discrete phase space provides a means of generating a complete set of mutually invariant bases. Okay, that's the first part of the talk. It also, using this rotation idea, provides a means of generating minimum uncertainty states in the Rennie sense, okay, which are indeed not typical. They are special states. They really are special minimum uncertainty states. They have some intriguing properties in their own right, but they're not like coherent states. They don't go to coherent states in some limit. In fact, they're really crazy-looking states, absolutely crazy-looking. They're minimum uncertainty states, but if they approach anything in a continuous limit, I think they approach something that's probably not differentiable. They don't look like they're coherent states. But we have a way of generating them. And I believe that is the end. So thanks very much for your attention. answer more questions. There were lots of nice questions during the time.
Yes, sure. You skipped a topic that I've written down about how introducing this rotation operator reduces the amount of
ambiguity. That's right. Oh, yeah, that's the last point. You know, I was mentioning earlier in the bigger function, you have all this freedom in assigning state vectors to lines of phase space. If you make use of one of these unitary operators, you just make the assignment once for, say, the vertical lines. You say you assign some standard state to the vertical ray. And then the translation operators determine what state you assign to all the other vertical lines. And then you use the unitary thing to tell you how to assign states to all the other lines, because you can take, because that unitary, it takes a basis to some other basis, or it takes states to other states, and it corresponds to a rotation operator, which takes lines to some other set of lines. And so by using that parallel between the rotation and the unitary, then you basically get a unique definition of a Wigner function once you've chosen your unitary operator.
So it's associated with choosing the good polynomial.
Which is a matter of choosing a good polynomial, exactly. So you're choosing how you define your circles. So that's a choice that you have to make. Right.
So normally coherent states are invariant under some symmetry.
Absolutely.
So in this case, that symmetry is the rotation.
Yeah, coherent states, and this was our motivation. This was our intuition. Coherent states, like say the ground state of the harmonic oscillator, just sitting there in the middle of phase space, here's position momentum. It's just sitting there. It's invariant if you scale your axes in the right way. It's invariant under rotations. It's not the only thing that's invariant under rotations. Every eigenstate of the harmonic oscillator is invariant under rotations. But at least we thought, well, this might could give us a handle on a discrete coherent state, because it's going to have this symmetry. Well, it has a symmetry. It just doesn't look like a coherent state, and it doesn't look like any higher energy eigenstate of both. Harmonic oscillator. It's a very funny thing. I don't completely understand it. But yeah, exactly. That symmetry is part of our intuition behind it. Yeah, Chris.
Can you go back to that picture of the coherent state with the three qubits?
Oh yeah.
So you found one uncertainty state, which has positive.
Which has a positive Wigner function. That's right.
That's for one choice of Wigner function, or did you try all?
Well, there are many choices that one has to. This is using the unitary to define the Wigner function. So that really does fix the Wigner function. So at least we had that. We didn't have that freedom. We use the unitary to define the Wigner function. Then we take our minimum uncertainty state, figure out its Wigner function.
Right.
So it's just a real number assigned to each point in phase space. It has to be constant on circles. This is a circle. And the thing is constant on that circle. This blue indicates some particular real number. The biggest value is right here at the origin, and so on. Yeah.
So for the ones that don't give you positive, you just have negative values under constant.
Yeah, that's right. They have negative values, and so when we found this, we thought, oh, we're in good shape. We found all these coherent-like states for the discrete for qubits for sets for because if it works for three qubits, of course it's going to work for other numbers, but it hasn't worked for any other number of qubits. Very bizarre.
I assume you've looked at this paper by, I think it was Gross, that
yes.
This unique definition of the Wigner function using a Fourier transform.
That's correct.
So
that's right.
Into your uniqueness.
That's very interesting, yes. And that only works for odd dimensions.
Okay.
David points out, because you have to divide by two. And you can't do that for even dimensions. Basically, what he's doing is taking the standard continuous Wigner function. It makes a lot of sense what he's doing. Take the standard continuous Wigner function and just sort of rewrite it for the discrete case. And it actually all makes sense as long as the dimension is odd.
My series only works when the connection is even.
Your
unique Wigner function.
Yes, that's true. That's true. Exactly. So these are kind of complementary results. We have a unique Wigner function for even dimensions, and he has a unique Wigner function for odd dimensions. So taken together, they sort of cover all the bases. Yeah. Richard.
Like so, for
You gave some MEV constructions in the first part of your talk.
Yeah.
I'm wondering if, like, for a given dimension, let's say power over time, are there genuinely different MEV constructions?
That is a very good question. And the answer is yes, right? And who has shown that?
Well, I don't know who originally showed it, but certainly Ernesto had, had looked at this and counted them for small numbers.
Right.
So I don't know if he was the one who originally found this or someone else had found it.
I know Debbie was asking about that years ago. May have answered it. Yeah, so that's interesting. Yeah, so this is one construction, but it's not the only one.
Okay, and there isn't a way to go between the different constructions, like by
I don't know about that. It's a great question.
Any more questions? Well, thank you very much.